So, as always, lovely to sit with you all. It's so great to see familiar faces and new faces. And again, thank you all for being here. Today, I want to share and play around with this room. I've been a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, I did a day long, and it might have been someone from this group who had recommended a book called Braiding Sweetgrass. And it's by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And I had purchased the book ages ago, but upon seeing it come up in the chat for the day long, I started listening to it on Audible. And in this book is a chapter called The Grammar of Animacy. And I've had such a great time listening to this chapter more times than I can admit, because it's what she's pointing to. And she is a professor of botany at a school in upstate New York, and she's a member of the Potawatomi tribe. And she's speaking about, in the language of her families, her lineage, her culture, 70% of the language is verbs, are verbs. In English, 70% of our language are nouns. And she points, like, well, in the culture, in the English language that's so dominated by things, it makes sense. And this essay opens up an awareness to what comes forth in her family's, her culture's lineage language, this notion of, again, things being many things, most things being verbs, and what that opens up to in terms of relating to the world. And I want to share some of her languaging, because she's just such a beautiful writer. And then I'll talk more about how this, for me, connects to the Dharma, because as I've spoke before, maybe last week or recently, about where we take refuge and refuge in Sangha, one of the triple gems in our community, and how important that is. Well, taking refuge in the Dharma is another vital refuge, one of the triple gems. The Dharma being truth, words, taking refuge in the truth that we come to understand through words. I was raised Catholic, and it was sort of the word of God, the importance of words. And yet there can be such a limiting factor of words. Words can be both expansive and they can be limiting. They can be so incredibly harmful. They can be so incredibly healing. And as I've spoken before of and referenced the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu's book on joy, one of the fundamental pillars of cultivating joy is a sense of perspective. And through these readings, which I'll get to in a minute from this book, just being able to tweak our perspective of how we relate to the world through the way language and our word choice forms our way of viewing the world. And yet it's just one way. It's the way through this particular lens of language. And I know there are those among us here that are multilingual or at least have another language. I've studied a lot of languages. I don't have any capacity in any of them, but in that, which I am not proud of at all. But there's a way of that there's a limit there of the capacity we have, and how our choice of words, our language, actually obviously influences the way we think. So I wanted to share some of this of her, what she writes. And again, the chapter is called The Grammar of Animacy, and animacy being anima, alive. So in this language, things are delineated by that which is alive and that which is not. In many European languages, things are either masculine or feminine. And again, just to consider that for a moment, that this language divides the world into that which is living and that which is not. The threads in my brain knotted. The harder I tried, the tighter they became. She's trying to learn this language, of which there are only nine fluent speakers of this language left, because during the era of the Carlisle schools, the Native American children were taken and their language was destroyed. They were not allowed to speak it. And the astonishing impact that would have on a culture to eliminate the language and all that was lost in this language. So there are nine speakers of this language left. And she's trying to try to wrap her mind around it, but it's really complex. So the threads in my brain knotted, and the harder I tried, the tighter they became. Pages blurred and my eyes settled on a word, a verb, of course, to be a Saturday. I threw the book down. Since when is Saturday a verb? Everyone knows it's a noun. I grabbed the dictionary and flipped through pages, and all kinds of things seemed to be verbs. To be a hill, to be red, to be a long, sandy stretch of beach. And then my finger rested on wigwagama, to be a bay. Ridiculous. I ranted in my head. There is no reason to make it so complicated. No wonder no one speaks this. It's a cumbersome language. Obey is most definitely a person, place, or thing. It is a noun, not a verb. I was ready to give up. Oh, the ghosts of the missionaries and the boarding schools must have been rubbing their hands in glee at my frustration. She's going to surrender, they said. And then I swear I heard the zap of synapses firing. An electrical current sizzled down my arm and through my finger and practically scorched the page on where the one word lay. In the moment, I could smell the water of the bay, watch it rock against the shore, hear it sift through and onto the sand. A bay is a noun only if water is dead. When bay is a noun, it's defined by humans trapped between its shores, contained by the word. But the verb wikwikwama, to be a bay, releases water from bondage and lets it live. To be a bay holds the wonder that for this moment, the living water has decided to shelter itself between these shores, conversing with cedar roots, a flock of baby mergansers, because it could do otherwise. It could become a stream, an ocean, a waterfall, and there are verbs for that too. To be a hill, to be a sandy beach, to be a Saturday, all possible verbs in a world where everything is alive. Water, land, even a day. The language is a mirror for seeing animacy, aliveness of the world, a life that pulses through things, through pines, through nuthatches and mushrooms. This is the language I hear in the woods. This is the language that lets us speak of that which is welling up around us. This is the grammar of animacy. Imagine seeing your grandmother standing at the stove in her apron saying, look, it's making soup. It has gray hair. We might snicker at such a mistake, but we would recoil from using it. In English, we would never refer to a member of our family as an it. It would be a profound act of disrespect. It robs a person of their selfhood, of kinship. It reduces a person to a mere thing. And so it is that in the Potawatomi language, in most other indigenous languages, we use the same words to address the living world as we use for our family, because we are all family. I have read this so many times because it just is astonishing to me of being able to move in the world in that way. And I'm actually in Southern California in the desert. And today I went for a walk early in the morning as the light was coming against a valley wall of rocks, and walked among the boulder people and just having that conversation with the rocks that were around me. Oh, these are the boulder people. It changed everything. And again, it's a switch of a word from boulders to the boulder people. And she says in the elders in her community will say, you need to go walk around the tall, you need to stand among the tall people, meaning the trees, go spend time with the beaver people. There are words for states of being that have no equivalent in English. The language that my grandfather was forbidden to speak is composed primarily of verbs, ways to describe the vital beingness of the world. Both nouns and verbs come in two forms. You hear a blue jay with a different word that you hear an airplane. You hear something that is alive differently than you hear a sound that has been man-made. It is distinguishing that which possesses a quality of life from that which is merely an object. Birds, bugs, berries are spoken with the same respectful grammar as humans, as if we were all members of the same family, because we are. There is no it for nature. Living beings are referred to as subjects, never objects. Personhood is extended to all who breathe and some who don't. I greet the silent boulder people with the same respect as I do the talkative chickadees. And again, this notion of honoring the aliveness of that which is around us. And she says that if you were to say, point to a table, you'd say, what is that? And the answer in the language would be, that is a table. But if you point to an apple, who is that? That being is an apple. And again, just to take a moment to think about how that might shift things for you. Right? That being is a banana. The word for plants in this language is the being that cares for us. That would change our relationship to the living world. That would change what can be such a profound sense of loneliness and isolation of particularly whites of European descent, of our disconnection from the world. What if we moved in the way of which, oh, now I'm in the community of tree people. I'm in the listening to the language of the wind that is alive. In this language, Yahweh is aliveness, being. in the Old Testament, it's the being, right? I mean, that's in this kind of astonishing overlay of languages, but this capacity to see the world in a very different perspective. And again, coming back to the teachings of the Dharma, I don't know this, but I would imagine that ideas such as the Dharma is alive. It's been alive for 20, it's been running for 2,600 years. And how can we relate to these teachings as living forces in our lives, the teachings of impermanence, that which arises passes away, be it the apple, the boulder, the valley, the canyons, the trees, the earth itself. It's always in movement. Right. There's a way in which it seems that we're taught, at least in the Dhamma culture, that things are fixed. We want to fix things. Fixity, it's static, it's solid, it's not moving. It doesn't work that way. It's constantly moving. It's moving and changing in ways that we like and that we don't like. What would it be like to imagine our lives as verbs, ourselves as verbs? A friend of mine who does amazing work, Taylor Ross, with families and children as a parenting coach, and she talks about kids as verbs. You know, your daughter is a verb, your son is a verb. And thinking in this in the last couple of days, we're all verbs. And what might that be like to hold our lives in that, in the past, present, future, and all the different ways of the grammar from high school that I can't even remember, past, present, participles, and all those things, the aliveness that we could infuse our sense of movement from when we're born to when we pass. We move through so many different times and stretches and ways that we identify. And what if we extended that sense of, right, of course, I'm always moving. I'm always changing. And the beautiful twin pairing of this notion of impermanence, that is a foundational teaching of Buddhism. Don't hold on to things. It's going to change. The thing that you thought you had, that job, that house, that relationship, that whatever, you're going to lose it. Not because you did anything wrong, although maybe you did and losing the job or whatever. Okay. It's part and parcel of this human existence on this realm. Things will come into our lives. They will go away. All that is dear to us, we will lose. Everything is a verb. How can we allow ourselves to let these teachings that say, the more you hold on to things, the more you try to fix things, the more you want things to be nouns and solid and still, the more you're going to suffer. The more willingness you have to hold things a little bit more loosely, a little bit more open-handed, more like verbs, you will suffer less. If you let go a little from Ajahn, you'll suffer less. You know, you'll suffer a little. If you let go a lot, you will, I'm not messing it up, but this nation, that notion of the more you let go, the happier, the more ease you will have, because there's a sense of being in the flow of life, of an understanding of, yes, this too, it comes in and it passes away. Read this poem, Rain on Water by Freya Manford. All afternoon, rain streams down on the lake until a break in the black clouds draws me out of the house into rocking waves. I dive through layers of darkness, layers of light. And when I come up for air, the sky echoes the underwater world, speaking the unspoken, not a warning or a godlike it shall be. More a wind-driven, earth-embracing word. And I swim to meet it from lake into sky. And next to this body is nothing, the mind less than the body. And only the country of the heart is equal to what I know. This movement, sky into water, layers of darkness, layers of light. It's in movement. Right, the light of the day, it is in movement. The light at 6 a.m. is different than at 7, that at 8, that at 9 o'clock at night. It's a verb. We're always in motion. These teachings, what we can relate to, what some of us might have related to 10 years ago, we don't relate to it in the same way. I've heard teachings, some of the same things taught over so many years, and each time it can ring differently because I'm in a different place to hear it. The words sound different. They land differently. The words are in motion, as am I. And being able to be, allowing ourselves to be in this poetry of constant movement, and it's okay. Our conditioning is no, fix it, hold it still, hold on, make it so, make it solid. It's not solid. We are not solid. the world around us is not actually solid. And this astonishing perspective from this language, and again, most indigenous language are verb-based, allows for such a deeper flow of understanding. I'm looking at my phone only because I have a quote from this book. We Americans are so reluctant to learn the language of our own species, let alone other species. But imagine the perspective we might have, the other intelligences that are out there, if we could listen to the wisdom of the Boulder people, the Tree people, the Beaver people. We would be so much less lonely if we availed ourselves of the life that is around us. If only we could see, if only our languaging allowed us to open up to that capacity to take in the world around us. Language is a mirror for how we interact with the world. Grammar is an understanding of how the context of these relationships. If we allow our own grammar to expand, to include these life forces that are around us, knowing that there is wisdom in these different life forces, how might we attune ourselves to that? I'm going to read one more poem, and then we'll do an exercise. You Are There by Erica Jung. You are there. You've always been there. And even when you thought you were climbing, you had already arrived. Even when you were breathing hard, you were at rest. Even then, it was clear you were there. Not in our nature to know what is journey and what is arrival. Even if we knew, we would not admit. Even if we lived, we would think we were just germinating. To live is to be uncertain. Certainty comes at an end. I think as I was preparing this morning, I think for me in many ways, poetry is a verb. I didn't put together until thinking about this because in many of the poems that I read, it feels like they too are imbued with a life. And sometimes you can read a poem and it's like, I don't understand it, but I can feel it. Or there's a beauty in the crafting of words that we might not necessarily put together that has its own life. And again, will land differently. We can hear a poem one day like, yeah. And then 5 years later, oh my God, it lands, it is alive. So I'm gonna ask you to close your eyes. And just to take a moment and check in how my words are landing. Again, an aliveness that you may like or not like. It may land, it may not. But just to check in. And then what it might it be like to consider this world that surrounds you wherever you are, be it in Germany, in Minnesota, South Carolina, Seattle, parts of Canada, parts of California. If you picture the landscape that you are located in, urban, suburban, rural, to picture and hold this landscape that holds you as alive, the trees around you as the tree people, the grasses, the plants, the flowers, the fruit in your house. This Thursday, as verbs, as alive, as movement, as expressions of a life force. What would it be like to allow yourself to take your place in the family of things, to borrow from David Wyatt? This family of things that is alive and around us. To allow this soft animal of our own bodies to love what it loves, to borrow from Mary Oliver. To allow this aliveness in our fathom-long form to resonate with the aliveness of that which is around us, if only we allow it to be alive. The trees, the plants, the grass, the animals, as beings, as sources of wisdom and life force. To allow ourselves to take our place in the community of things that are alive and surround us. As the outer circle, to move in a few rings in holding ourselves also as verbs in motion, in constant movement. Again, the line from Devi, we guess that we grow younger towards our death. This process of aging and changing, the different stages of our lives, the different stages of how we are in an hour, in a day. We are always in motion. We are verbs. And what is it like to consider ourselves as verbs, the people we love, also as verbs? This life, our place in this world, motion, movement, aliveness, these teachings on compassion and wisdom and insight, clear seeing as alive, companions, this notion of the benevolence of these beings as our companions, these teachings, this day, these bodies of water, these trees, these plants, these animals. What's it like to live in that world of aliveness, of companionship, of different languagings of wisdom and truth? I think I'll stop there and thank you for your kind attention.